Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to Yes But Why episode 267, my chat with comedian and corporate MC, Jeff Rogers. But first, let's talk about our sponsors. Yes But Why is brought to you by Audible. Sign up today for your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. You get a free audiobook download as well as access to hundreds of books and podcasts. I am right in the middle of Revelation, which is an Audible original book written and performed by Russell Brand. I love him, and I'm really loving this book. There's so much good stuff. I bet you find a ton of things. Go now to audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy to sign up and get your Audible account today. Yes But Why is also sponsored by PodcastCadet.com. PodcastCadet.com is the company that my husband and I started to help new podcasters figure out the right path for them. Go to PodcastCadet.com and connect with us. We will do whatever it takes to help you on your way to improving your podcast. Use promo code YBY20 to get 20% off the first service or workshop you buy. Let us help you. PodcastCadet.com. Yes But Why is brought to you by True Hemp Science. True Hemp Science is our Austin-based resource for vegan-friendly whole plant extract CBD oil. We connected with the owner, Christopher Lynch, at one of the local Austin farmers markets, and when we tried his products and loved them, we just had to get him as a sponsor. Go to truehempscience.com now to check out all of the CBD products available to you. Use code YESBUTY7 to get 7% off your order of $50 or more. You get all of the therapeutic goodness of CBD, plus you'll get a free packet of two yummy CBD edibles with your order. TrueHempScience.com. This week on Yes But Why, I interview Jeff Rogers, comedian, corporate MC, author, actor, and award-winning creative director. Listen in as we chat about his experience of Chicago improv in the late 80s, early 90s. Jeff tells me all about Jo Forsberg and how she was his improvisational inspiration. We talk about his book, The Playmaker Mindset, and the idea of channeling your creativity to achieve your goals. Support Jeff Rogers by taking classes with him at the Players Workshop or by hiring him for your next corporate event. I now present to you Yes But Why episode 267, Jeff Rogers on improv and using your innate creativity to make money. Enjoy. I'm Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why Podcast. Yeah. What was the first time in your life that you felt a creative spark? How did it get started for you?
Pass. Next question. Is this for the points? This is still for... Okay.
You win 100 points. You win.
Oh, sweet. I have an enormous family. I am the 10th of 11 children. So there was always an audience at my house. We are all extremely fast, extremely funny. And you did not last long at the dinner table if you weren't able to keep up. So as one of the youngest kids, I was able to see everybody's kind of style, if you will. And my next eldest brother, shared my sense of humor and my sense of timing. And so we grew up watching comedy together. A lot of stuff on PBS, Dave Allen at Large, Fawlty Towers, Monty Python, Benny Hill, mostly because Benny Hill had naked ladies every now and then. Mm-hmm. It's important to get all of the input. But we really did share that same idea of what was funny. So I had an immediate playmate in comedy. I had a comic partner. We couldn't be more different as individuals. He was definitely a Felix. I was an Oscar. And so I think, and my dad was a a very sharp guy, very funny guy. And my mom had a great sense of humor as well. So although they weren't show people at all, everybody was very much, you know, charming Irish fun people who had a quick wit and a fun sense of humor. So that was present like almost every day. So I say almost because, you know, we still got in trouble. We were still idiots most of the time.
There are 11 kids. There's going to be some rough days.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that to me was normal. But speaking in front of an audience is normal for me. It took me years to figure out that that was the case. I was backstage one time for an event, and a guy came up to me and said, do you get nervous? And I was like, no, that's my office. When I go out on stage, that's the office. That's my job, you know? And he could not, couldn't fathom how that could be the case, but it really is.
Totally. I feel the same. Yeah. It's the only place I feel completely comfortable.
Absolutely. And that's just it's a very nice feeling. It's very warm. It's very generous. I think some people look at it adversarially,
yeah,
like it's a thing to conquer. I've always looked at it as it's a party to join.
Yeah.
And, had a ball with it the entire time that I'm a part of it. So,
yeah, I like to think of it like I would make friends with all of you individually, but this way is easier for me to do it just once.
That's great. Very economical, right? Super efficient.
Yeah.
Let's just we're all going to get along, but this way. It's just much faster.
We just get right through it. You know me now. Just come up to me later. I'm available to chat.
And you're cool, right? So we're good.
Yeah.
And then now you know I'm cool. And yeah. Yeah, that's great. I love that.
It's like group friend making. It's a good thing.
It's the most intense networking event ever. All right. So welcome to a group network. What's going to happen is you're going to get up on stage in front of 1,000 people. Just be yourself. Just totally be yourself. Don't be nervous. You're going to walk away with 1,000 friends.
Yeah. It is funny though that people have different, you know, like points of view of that kind of thing that like, you're right. Most people are like deathly afraid of this idea. And I really like what you're saying about how they look at it adversarially. Adversarially. Yep. You said it good and I'm going to stick with that.
Yeah,
you did
let's
it.
Go with that. Just, you know what? Edit that in. Use that one time because now I'm afraid to say it again.
No, don't say it. Yeah, absolutely not. I'll just cut it out and just put it back in. Yeah, it's fine.
That's awesome.
You are smart, and I like what you said moments ago.
Perfect. I always look at walking out on stage like I'm the, so I do a lot of corporate hosting and stuff. I'm bouncing around a little bit, but I do a lot of corporate hosting.
Yeah.
For meetings and events. And I walk out on stage with the idea that I'm a host of a party. My job is to make sure that everybody has a good time. Mm-hmm. Now, I also do keynote speaking. I also do improvisation on stage. And I've been on stage for a majority of my life. I have always walked out on stage with the idea that we're all here for a good time. Even if it's a dramatic play or something along those lines, we're all here to enjoy the experience and feel the emotions. So I've never looked at it as sort of a hill to climb or something, a challenge to overcome. It's much more about, you know, this is going to be awesome. Let's all get on the sled and here we go down the hill and maybe we'll fall off, which we'll all be giggling after that as well.
Well, I think there's a certain level of once you realize that people will listen to you if you talk to them in a large crowd. Because I think that's another part of why people have a hard time with speaking on stage is they have that complex of like, well, nobody wants to hear what I have to say. Whereas a lot of us who are performers are like, everybody wants to know what I say. So, yes. I mean, I wouldn't have a 200 plus episode podcast if I didn't think somebody wanted to know what I have to say, right?
It was critical. It's that they knew what you wanted.
Yeah, so much of what I have to say. Hours of just me talking. But, you know, some people don't think that they have anything to bring to the table. And so was there a point where you were like, I just know that I have this skill to, like, make people comfortable and have a good time, and I'm going to use it on stage? How did you become a host?
Well, I definitely did all of the stuff in high school. I did all the plays and the musicals in high school and that type of thing.
Awesome.
My sister went through, at the time, Goodman Theater up here in Chicago, pretty well-known theater, right? That they had an education program, the Goodman School of Drama. And it was a pretty big deal. And she had just graduated from there and was doing some shows around Chicago, and I got to go see one of her shows. Now she's 17 years older than me, 16 years older than me. So I'm a kid, and I see her up on stage. She'll hate me for this. I think she was playing a donkey in a kid's show, mm-hmm. Sacramento 50 Miles. That was the name of the kid's show. Mm-hmm. And I saw her doing that, and I was like, oh, if there was a moment maybe that clicked that you could do this and like for real, I think that might've been the moment, because she was up on stage playing make-believe and getting reactions from everybody like we do around the kitchen table. And so then it was sort of, there was value to it then. It wasn't just for goofing around sake, there was something more to it. And I think if there was one point where in my little prepubescent head that I thought, ding, light bulb, that was probably it. And then from that point on, I was always doing the shows. I was doing a little writing. I rewrote an Abbott and Costello sketch for a talent show in grade school, and went on to, you know, high school musicals. And I actually, I dropped out of college because it was taking too long.
Sure.
It was like, okay, look, can we just do it? Can we just do it? Can we?
You know how many hours of stage time I'm missing?
Yeah, that's exactly, for the love of all that's holy. Come on. So
that's the pull quote. He quit college to get more stage time. It's great.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
Mom, yeah, don't listen.
I wanted to go right into it. And so I started doing stand up in the late 80s. That was the thing to do. I was still 19 years old. So I was literally, I got a fake ID to go do stand up as opposed to go and drink in the bars. Mind you, I did drink at the bars, but that wasn't the point.
No.
And actually, while I was doing stand up at the Golden Apple Pub, in Chicago, Amy Sedaris, Paul Dinello, who is now the executive producer of the Colbert Show, and Lou Saliba were doing improv at the open mic that I was performing stand-up at. And Amy came to me and said, listen, what you're doing is not, you're not doing stand-up. You're doing improv. You just don't know that that's what you're doing. And she's like, go to this place, Players Workshop, go take some classes, because you can get a lot better at it. And, it was kind of like, wow, yeah, but I'm pretty awesome as it is because I'm 19 and bulletproof. Mm-hmm. But it was the best advice I'd ever gotten, because that got me involved in the whole idea of improvisation. And, that was absolutely the sort of springboard to everything else I did for the rest of my life.
Wow. That's pretty great. I just heard an interview with her talking about how it was her brother suggesting she take classes that led her. So she's probably just paying it forward, because she was like, this helped me so much, I'm going to tell everyone that I think should do it to do it. And that's so great that she touched, it got right to your creative center and like got you into something so cool.
Well, and I think anybody who takes improvisation and falls in love with it kind of feels like, and I still feel this, everyone should take improv.
Yeah.
Everyone should take the classes. Doesn't matter if you go to be on stage or anything else with it. You should take it so that you are able to utilize these tools everywhere throughout life. I own the Players Workshop in Chicago, which is the oldest school of improv in the country, an independent school of improvisation anybody can come to. Our motto is improvisation for life. It's not just for on stage, not just for SNL. It's not just for, it is for living. Mm-hmm. And I think that I honestly believe the tools that you learn there, the skills that you learn, are the ones that will stick with you and serve you best throughout your entire life. So
I could not agree more.
I get pretty religious about it.
Please, you do not need, you're preaching to the choir. I am into it. I'm like, improv could heal the world. If like people, we should go to the UN and be like, guys, just give us like 3 days of solid improv. You guys would be like working together like a well-oiled machine. It wouldn't be any more fighting. It would be like, I know exactly what they want over here because I understand them, right?
Yeah. Oh, and I've got their back. You know? I'm gonna make them look good as opposed to having that, you know, making myself.
Right. Not to mention the fact that like legit, if I was not an improviser, I don't think I would have made it through the last year and a half. Like,
oh,
just coping mechanisms, coupled with the ability to like etch a sketch something forward, you know, where it's like, wow, I can't deal with that right now. Okay. New thing. Like, you know, and just juggling. The juggling of like a bunch of different things that don't make sense come together. What do you do with them? Okay, well, we're going to make something.
Absolutely.
You know, so much of this last year was like just insane circumstances being thrown at me. And I'd be like, okay, all right, we can puzzle into something.
Yeah, and I would say that the two parts that I think go hand in hand in that is the idea that, one, let's jump in and start doing it because we're already in it. We're in the pandemic, so we have to react to it. And where you are, what you make of where you are, is a critical aspect to what will determine where you go. And if your position is always one of, I'm just in reaction the whole time, as opposed to in response to, you get lost pretty quick, I think. What I think improv teaches you as well is the confidence to know two things. One is either we're going to succeed. I have enough confidence in our collective intelligence, knowledge, and experience that we are going to be able to come up with something that's going to be able to get us to the next point in whatever, wherever we want to go, either jointly or individually, and then bringing it together. The second part of that is, and I think the more critical thing you learn in improvisation is, or not, you're going to fail.
Yeah.
And if that failure is what drags you down into the mud and makes you stop doing stuff, then you aren't going to get far. You have to be able to take that failure and look at it as opposed to win or lose. It's win or learn. Mm-hmm. And that's what you learn in improvisation. You learn it's, I don't want to do that in this scenario. I want to support this player, or I want to make sure I'm doing my object work or my physicality. Mm-hmm. I want to be aware of my space. I want to make sure I'm not just talking to fill the void as opposed to having a really cool silent moment that raises the tension. You know, you learn that by trial and error, but everyone gets so, we've become as a society so afraid of the error portion of it. That I think that's how improvisation could literally help cure the world. Like you're talking about, just to get back to that space of, and I have a whole thought about this, this is a space of play. Mm-hmm. When we're in the mindset of play, we totally lower the stakes and our game is raised, right? And when we're in that state of play, we're able to try things, we're more flexible, we're doing all of this stuff. And that's where the genius comes out of all of us. The spark of the universe, whatever that is, the stardust that's within us, that's when we're able to access it. Professor Csikszentmihalyi, Mikhail Csikszentmihalyi did a whole thing on flow, the state of flow, where you're able to access all of your really good stuff for a long period of time. And so he's out of the University of Chicago, and he's written a couple of books on it. And there's this whole thought of when you are aligned in your passion and you're at the edge of your ability is when you're in a state of flow. And that's when you tend to do your best work. And you even kind of surprise yourself like, wow, I didn't think I could stretch that extra couple of feet or do that extra couple of things. It's easy to see in sports, but we all experience it. I think of that as play. When we're at a state, when we're in that state of play, we're able to try things for way longer. We're able to maintain that passion for way longer than we would normally or when we would typically give up. So it really becomes this idea of, okay, how can I go back to playing and embrace that again, and then share that in the space that I am, whatever job I have, whatever work that I do, to make play a part of my day, as opposed to, you know, pushing it aside and just, yeah, you put your nose to the grindstone, soon enough you get ground down. And who wants to live like that?
Yeah. Plus people just can't, like, they can't get out of their own way with a certain level of like negativity mixed with, you're talking about, they need confidence. They don't have the confidence, right?
Right.
And the other part is that in improv, you have to spend so much time with the group that's going to perform to have them trust each other. And I don't think we trust each other in the world anymore. Like right. People to people on the street, no. People that are you're working with, no. People absolutely that you not. Have a relationship with potentially, no. Like there's just a lot of, you know, places where there is no trust to be had. Plus, like, I always look to like art as a reflection of what the culture thinks.
Where
right?
we're at, yeah.
And in the last few years, I've noticed that plot lines have ended a lot more darkly, and the characters are allowed to show more of what is a dark side in a way that's less like this guy's a villain and more like, yeah, we all have dark sides. And I appreciate that, this acknowledgement that we're not all just like perfect characters that are all like, it's fine, I lost my job. But at right. the same time, like they focus a lot on this idea of this like troubled person with this like terrible, they can't deal with it. If I read another like show description that's like cop having a really hard time and his family doesn't understand, I'm like, yep, that's pretty much what these shows are all about, right? But that's the character. The character that we're looking at is someone to reflect ourselves. And the problem is with all these negative shows about these tough people who are never going to learn and it's never going to go well for this guy.
Yeah.
You then watch that show and then you go out and you're like, well, I guess nothing's ever going to work for me. I can't trust anybody. I mean, look at this guy. Everyone's murdering everyone all around him. And you're like, he's a homicide detective? And they're like, no, no, it's what happens in life. You know,
who said that who's got that quote? If you stare into the void too long, the void looks back. Have you ever heard that?
No.
Oh, I don't know if
nightmare.
It's Nietzsche or it was a philosopher.
Yeah, it was definitely Nietzsche. Yeah,
it sounds very Nietzsche, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But I think you're absolutely right. I think if you consume too much of that reality, that becomes your reality. I was actually just thinking about that today in terms of where we are with our society, that we've eliminated our trust. We've eroded the trust in our institutions, i.e. the courts, the justice system, all of these things that there are absolutely aspects of it that need reframing and rebuilding, right? But there's a core. There has to be a core there, because otherwise you can't trust anything that we've ever built, right? That humanity, that society has ever built. And so now it's, okay, well, I don't trust anything. And I think we're getting peaks now into, okay, where does that lead people down? Well, they don't trust the vote. They don't trust the any of that stuff. And I'm not even, you know, casting aspersions around anybody's beliefs. But the idea that after 3 and 4 recounts, we have to do it again because we don't believe that it was done right. And that belief, there's no way that comes back, right? I think that's lost, and it has to either be rebuilt, or I honestly am afraid of what the other thing is. I don't even want to say.
It's like when you bring your baby daddy on Maury Povich to find out if he's actually the baby daddy. Do you really think at the end of that you guys are going to have a healthy relationship? Because you're not.
Right. Right. Like that. There it is. Okay. Here we go. No, that's still the people. That's still the guy who was saying, no, I'm not. And, or the woman who's saying, no, you're not. And it's like that they're saying no. If you're on Maury, someone on the two, one of the two people, 50% of that relationship has said no. So just, you don't even need to know. Walk away. Mm-hmm. Just walk away.
Yeah. If you can't develop that trust between that, in that relationship, in the world, to bring it back in your improv team, there's no way they're going to be able to communicate. There's no way you're going to get to this ease of the flow to actually be able to experience it. That's why a lot of people will take like an improv 101 class and then be like, yeah, it's not for me. It was like, okay. And sometimes it's like, yeah, all right, it's not for you. And then sometimes it's like, yeah, you didn't really let your guard down at all. Like there was no point where you let anyone in. Like, I'm really sorry that you didn't like these four people that were in your class, but like the whole point of this is to let your guard down and experience other people, and then your like energy of friendship goes on stage and does a recital show.
Yeah.
Like no one, P.S. No one's going on Improv 101 show for a good time. Right? No one's like, you know what's going to be the most hilarious thing you've seen in a long time? No. They're going because they love you, right? Your friends are there. They want to support you. And you and those other people had an experience together. And this is your, hey, guys, guess what we did?
And those are the people who you do feel like, oh, if you would just stick through it, this would be a major life event for you. Mm-hmm. You would crack something that you have been carrying around, holding in front of you for so long that if you stuck with this and you did it right and you invested in it, it would be therapeutic, right? Because improv should never be therapy, but it can be really therapeutic for people. Mm-hmm. And that's, yeah, you hate to see those, fish get off the line because it's right there. They're literally in the, they're in the glow of it, and I'm not gonna. Speaking of self-sabotage, speaking of reverting back to what they know as opposed to what they're capable of.
It's scary. It can be scary. Like you and I are talking about, we happen to be people who have ease on stage. A lot of people don't, right? That element creates this barrier for them, and then they can't even talk to another human being. I teach 101. Class one, I go sit on those chairs on the stage and have a conversation with each other. And they're like, about what? And I was like, have you guys ever met? Anything.
Just there. Just stop right there. The fact that the first two, about what? Like, no. You just have to converse with each other. You've done this. You've actually done this exercise. Mm-hmm. You're all familiar with it.
In your life. Yeah. On the daily. But whatever, you could ask her why she took the improv class. How about that? Like, doesn't matter at all. I was like, we just both found out you guys are both from Pittsburgh. Chat about that or whatever, you know?
Yeah. The very similar thing when people are doing mic checks. Can you speak into the mic for us for a little bit? What do you want me to say? Say anything you want. Go ahead. Just need to get a level. 1, 2, 3. Do you need more? Like, dude, what are you doing? Just tell us. And then it's, tell us what you had for breakfast. Eggs. Okay. What we need is sustained talking from you. I had orange juice too. You know what? We're good. Thank you. Thank you very much. We're good.
By the way, in your show, is there a lot of low tone talking like you're doing? Could you try to? Oh, because when you do your show, we're going to have dialed the mic down because you're whispering right now.
Yeah. We're going to crank that up. We'll see if we see what we can get out of the game.
Oh,
yeah.
My God.
So it is hysterical that I think that people have these expectations going into it. And it really is a matter of if they're at a point to want to change. Or not. I mean, it's as scary for everybody, for almost everybody who goes into it, as anything else is frightening. And so they have to be at a point where the pain of not changing is greater than the pain of changing. Mm-hmm. So unless they're at that point, it's very difficult to get them to, to expand their comfort zone, to walk into that uncomfortable space. And really, and that's how I look at it, is you're comfortable here anytime you need to grow, anytime you learn, you're vulnerable. You only grow by learning. So, i.e., in order to learn, in order to grow, you will be uncomfortable. You will be vulnerable. And if you are incapable of allowing that, that fear of failure, that fear of getting hurt, the fear of being embarrassed, if you're incapable of withstanding that, you will not be able to take that step. You will not. So you have to be at a point where I'm willing to give up my security for knowledge, you know? So it's the eternal sort of the eternal struggle that even, you know, Adam and Eve, right? They gave up their security for knowledge effectively.
Oh, yeah.
We went somewhere. Here we are.
Look at that. Look, Adam and Eve. We're nailing that. Yes. Yes.
Oh,
amazing.
Yeah.
We've referenced Nietzsche, the Bible. Guys.
Come on.
This is some like heady stuff right here.
Who thought they were walking into this podcast for that?
Whoa.
Come on.
Whoa. Hey, this is some serious stuff right here. You know, it's funny. I feel like I was talking about how I want improv to heal the world. I feel like these people that we're talking about are like most of the world, where we're noticing that people have a tendency to put their head in the sand for various reasons. And improv could heal the world, but they do need to get to that point, like you're talking about, of vulnerability, of like being willing to open the door. The door's there. The door's there always, right? First, 100%. They have to acknowledge the door exists, and then they have to open that door, right? And it's like you know, 101 exercises where you're like, there's a box right there, pick it up. And they're like, there's not a box there. And you're like, okay, there's a box right there, pick it up. And they're like, oh, okay, great. I'm like, what's in the box? And they're like, I don't know. You just told me it was here. Make something up. What's in the box? Okay. Yeah. So sometimes people just don't want to like take these steps, right? And that's fine. That's fine. You know, for the rest of us who are into it, I agree with you. Improvisation for life helps my life, helps everything about the way I deal with the world. You know, even my husband and I talk about it. I have a rough memory. I have an Etch-a-Sketch brain. And he's like, it's because you trained your brain to be in the moment. He's like, your effort that you worked on for 10 years to train your brain to like literally only be here now. And the rest of it will happen later, right? And it's true. I can so deeply live in the moment, right? Are there 100 things that I'm like, you know, in my mind or on my to-do list for the rest of the day? Yeah, sure. But right now in this moment, I'm here with you because that's what I want, because that's that's the situation that I've chosen to do. Some people are just so distracted, they can't even calm their brain to get there, right? That's another thing. Oh,
absolutely.
You can use this as a brain, like...
cleanse.
Yes, cleanse. Good word.
Right? Yeah.
I was going to say lots of words that weren't words. So cleanse is a great one. Brain cleanse. Absolutely. So let me ask you a question. So you're talking about Players Workshop, and you say that this is your theater that you own, and it's been around for a long, long time. You mentioned, is this the same group that Amy Sedaris told you to take classes at?
Yes.
So did you like go take classes and then like so love it, it like became yours? How did this happen?
Kind of. So let me give you a quick history of Players Workshop, because I'm also its biggest fan because of the woman who started it. Josephine Forsberg started Players Workshop. It started as Players Workshop of Second City. And the reason that was is because Josephine Forsberg, who was an actress, an improviser, and just all around brilliant, brilliant person. She was part of the original cast at Second City. She didn't perform on opening night because she was literally giving birth to her first kid, Eric Forsberg. Yeah, just a little busy. It was an unpaid night off from the cast. But so she is sometimes forgotten about in terms of her place in sort of the pantheon of improvisers. But she was critical, I think as critical as Viola Spolin, because she took what Viola was teaching at Second City. Viola Spolin was only at Second City for a few years, right? This is Paul Sill's mom, who worked with Neva Boyd, taught improv to kids back in the 30s as part of the Works program. One of her kid, Paul Sills, brought it to University of Chicago. University of Chicago got a group together. They did a couple of different theaters, Compass Players, and that morphed into Second City. Okay, big landmark improv place, right? Viola was only there for a couple of years at the beginning, teaching everybody who came in how to improvise. No one knew how to improvise. No one was walking in the door, oh yeah, I took improv in college as an act. That didn't exist. So you had actors and performers who would walk in and she would teach them how to do it. Josephine, who was also part of the cast, also, you know, sort of watched along with Viola as she was teaching other people and became her acolyte. And after she left, they said, okay, Joe, you've been watching this whole thing. You teach people now. So every cast that they would have to rebuild, including the casts with, you know, Belushi and Murray and all these famous people who came out of it, she was the one who was teaching everybody how to improvise. And what was happening was all of these actors who were working at Second City, all of a sudden were bringing other actors like, you have to learn this form. This is one of the best stage skills you can learn as a performer, as an actor. You have to learn this. So finally, there's, you know, it's a cast of seven and there's, you know, 25, 30, 40 people in the room learning how to do this. And so she was like, okay, I think I'd like to open up a conservatory to teach improvisation. Well, the owners at Second City were like, yeah, we don't want to do that. We're a theater. We're not going to do that. So, okay, I'm going to open up this other place, Players Workshop of Second City. If you wanted to work at Second City, you had to take classes there. And, you know, a bunch of people went through the classes there. The Harold Ramis, Bill Murray, Bonnie Hunt, George Wendt, Shelley Long, Amy Sedaris, Matt Walsh. So all of these people went through Players Workshop. Jimmy Corrine, if you're familiar with Jimmy, and Robert Smigel, the insult dog, and great writer and everything else. But that's how a lot of people know. Right. This place became, and this is where Improv Olympics started. Dell was teaching there, and it became this place where Dell came together with Sharna Halpern and David Shepherd came there to try out this Improv Olympiad thing, and that became IO. So, I mean, Players Workshop really was this nexus point of learning improvisation in the country. And then, so I went through it in the late 80s, in 89, and about 10 to 15 years later, it closed its doors. Her kids didn't want to take it over. There was a conservatory at Second City. All of these other places had schools. The reason I wanted to bring it back was I had taken classes with Dell. I had taken classes with a lot of other people. I felt that no one was teaching the foundational elements of improvisation like they used to at Players. And this included how to be on stage, presenting yourself, all of the stuff that all of us know. But there are so many aspects to creating characters and doing things along those lines, creating that empathy, working with each other, making the other player look good, that also can be used elsewhere. What she found was she had accountants and lawyers and salespeople and moms and everybody else taking classes and then not going on to be actors. They just wanted to go on and be in touch with their more creative selves. And I didn't feel like there was a place that was doing that in Chicago. And I went to her just before she passed and said, I want to restart it. I can't send anybody that I don't think wants to be an actor but really should learn how to improvise. I have no place to send them. They go to Second City, get lost in that group of people who want to be on Second City, which is fantastic. You know, that's great. God, I was one of them. I got on the Second City stage. So I get that. But that's not where I want to send somebody who's a complete newbie to improvisation to get lost in sort of that undertow. It was important to me to do that. She was excited about the idea of restarting it and launching it again for just those reasons. And then the recession hit and it became, you know, too difficult to do for a while. And then I got the opportunity to restart it. So I want to tip the hat to Jo, because she really did put together, she curated a curriculum that really brought somebody from zero to 100 in 6 months, so that they could walk on stage anywhere and improvise with the best improvisers there are, and feel absolutely confident that the knowledge they have, they can use in any form with anybody else who's doing it. And, or not, or take it back to where they work and be more open to ideas and use that sense of play as a way to really get through their day and get through their relationships in a better way, to relate and communicate better than they ever have before. So that's really where we are now. We're teaching classes virtually, because it, you know, because of the pandemic. We opened in 2019, and then 6 months later, and so, but we've been doing it virtually and doing well with that. And so now we're going to reopen at some point, hopefully late summer, early fall. We'll see how things go, as long as everybody can be safe. But this is not it didn't make it type of thing. It's, we're going to be around for the next 50 years. Our size will probably grow and shrink, but this form, the way this is taught, needs to be there and needs to be in Chicago, frankly, because I think of Chicago as the home of it, right? As a bit of a mecca for improvisation. Given what's happened over the last year with IO closing, I mean, certainly a pillar in the community, in what it was doing. That said, obviously it had some problems. Second City, another pillar in the community, has been sold, and its problems were revealed, and they're working on those. So now all of a sudden, Chicago is that sort of mecca. I think foundationally has been shook a little bit, and that may be a good thing for the form. My fear is that improv could go the way of jazz. I mean, let's be honest, we've only been around for about 50, 60 years, 70, is it 70 years? So, I mean, maybe jazz had a heyday. I mean, and it's still got some clubs out there and it's still got all of this stuff, but it could go the way of jazz in that it's a very small art form that's performed on the fringes.
Some could argue that would be a good thing.
I don't think so. I think that it is an American art form that should be celebrated and brought more into the light. Hmm. But with a level of quality that really does allow for the best things to rise to the top, yeah. which would necessitate pay, which would necessitate performers being able to make a living at it so that they are able to pursue it to the extent that they're capable. Hmm. You know what I mean? Instead of, well, I'm going to just sacrifice my life so that I can pursue my art. No, you should be able to have both, you know, and, you know, whether that's a new system for arts in this country in terms of being subsidized, which would be fantastic. Or if it's just that, okay, if you're going to open an improv theater, you have to have a plan to pay the performers. Mm-hmm. And that just has to be part of your financial due diligence and, you know, make it work.
I think this time that we've had off, like this period in which essentially all live performance has been moot, like it's not happening in, you know, theater, straight theater, musical theater.
Right.
It's not happening in improv theater, stand-up. Stand-up occasionally, if only just because there's only one person, so they felt somehow safer to continue to do that, which is fine. But at the same time, like, I feel like all this time to sit around and talk and figure it out and to watch business after business close for various reasons. Sometimes it's like, oh yeah, running a business is hard. And sometimes you're like, oh yeah, it is hard to run a business when there's no cash flow. And then there are just other things where it was like, they had a minute, and so all of the evils of it came to light, and they were like a crashed down, right? But right. I feel like I feel like all of theater has to rebuild itself, every bit of it, like improv and stage theater and musical theater,
yeah.
residential, Broadway, like Broadway's trying to come back right now, and people are really getting on to how it's happening and what's going on to make sure that it does reflect the changes that the sort of larger community has been like, okay, wait, didn't we say that we all wanted people to be paid properly and for there to be opportunities for people no matter what they look like and what's going on and why do they all have to be famous? Like, could right. someone that's not famous be on Broadway? I get they're bored too now, but, you know, let's possibly get some of these actors that have been working for 20 years to try to get on this stage, perhaps,
yeah.
you know, and I feel like there's been a lot of improv theaters that have closed and that has helped, I think, because people across the country and across the world are talking to each other and they are communicating about like what needs to be the standard. And I'm hoping, you know, in the way we were talking about earlier, we have to trust that people are that the right things are going to happen. Right. If I don't trust that it's going to work out, it's not going to work out. Right. So my trust is that this time we've had all this time to reflect and say, OK, you know what? If I have a theater, this is what it's got to be. This is what I've got to communicate. These are the things that are the most important because there's been all this time, you know, to consider and to reflect on, you know, I've been part of this and that wasn't good because of this reason. Oh, and this company broke down because they were this. I've been trying to look into, was it all the for-profit companies that that broke down? Are the nonprofits still there? Is that like legal distinction something that helps one versus the other? Like, just from my point of view, because like I have no intention of opening a theater right now, but like, I mean, let's be clear, like I probably will. Like, if only just because like I love theater so much, I'll do all the right. dumb things, right?
Right.
But you know, there's a lot to be learned. And so I'm glad that, you know, I know that it's hard for you to like just start and then be like, nope, can't do it. But I feel like the world, like during the break, we all got a little, you know, we took the gauze from our eyes and we're like, wait, oh my God, I can see. Oh, you mean I need to be nice to people for them to want to be in my improv school? I don't understand. What do you mean? I have to pay everyone properly so that they can live their lives? What is this? You know,
I have to bring in diverse voices. I have to be inclusive. I have to be understanding of, you know, workplace harassment. I have to.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. That. How is that not understood?
It's like,
why is this like a surprise?
Yeah, it's like a full community build. It's like you need to acknowledge. And those are the parts, too. That's the other thing, too. If you, knowing all these things, as you move forward, it's like you have to do all these things. If you're not ready to do them, don't open your theater, right?
Don't do
to
it.
To other
yeah.
people, right? Not right. to you. You're ready. I can see how ready you are. But like you got a sweet logo behind you. It's looking good.
It's like
the logo's done. So
what
clearly
else?
The business plan has been written, right?
But it. Yeah, you can tell. If you've done the logo.
Yeah.
Because no one ever starts with that. Oh, you know what would be cool if we had the logo? Yeah, no, but you're absolutely right. That is absolutely, table stakes now, which I have no idea how that wasn't to begin with, especially what is surprising to me is in these things that come out, these stories that come out, of the stuff that people have gone through in these theaters. Where, I mean, some of them I worked at, I was at Second City for years, almost a decade. I wasn't aware of some things. Some things have absolutely been, were right in front of us and we didn't have the intelligence or the empathy to realize how bad they were and how impactful they were. And we should have. So there's absolutely a mea culpa in that. But there's some stuff where it was like, wait a minute, that happened? That level of oppression, that level of, you know, you hear about some of these meetings and you're just like, I can't believe that the people in power actually said those things out loud to another person. Like, at what point in your life did you decide that was okay to say to anybody? All of that stuff, I absolutely think you're right. It's fantastic that that facade has been lifted, and you could see the cockroaches scurrying from the light that's been shown on that. But it was surprising about it was that in our community, the improv community, which was, you know, supposed to be built on this equity and this empathy and supporting each other, it, you know, turned out to be, you know, white guys making fun of everybody, which is a big part of where it was. And as a white guy, hopefully that whole perspective is going to change significantly. I think Second City did some great moves post some of this stuff coming out with whom they've hired. Their new executive producer, I think, is, I'm excited for him. I wish that, because they've made some other moves that were just kind of stupid in terms of the night staff and the people who've been working there for a long time who helped make it, you know, an inviting environment, the people, the wait staff, the ticket booth, the all of that stuff. So there was some stuff done there that I thought, that's unfortunate that the new owners wanted to take those steps. But artistically, it's really interesting to see how hard they're going in the right direction. And it's like, and the people that they're bringing up, the guy, John Carr, I think his name is the new executive producer, came coming up from Atlanta. Everything this guy has said, I'm just like, okay, he just sounds absolutely dreamy. I'm so happy. I haven't heard one bad thing about him either from folks in Atlanta or from the folks in Chicago. So if that's the way we could go, if all of that came to, you know, this level of growth, that this could be a shining light. Okay. Totally worth it. Totally, absolutely, yes. Let's go that way, and with strength and vigor and passion.
I didn't know that the new person running it was from Atlanta. I think it's a really smart move to get somebody from a different city, if only just like fresh eyes, you know?
Absolutely. And he's an African American man who brings that experience with him, and has that experience to guide and to lead. So now it really is okay. Yeah, all of these kind of awful things, not kind of awful things that happened over the years, now literally has someone who has gone through some stuff, has that experience, and knows how to hopefully right the ship. I mean, Second City surviving is a good thing for all improv companies in my estimation. So
yeah, I think so.
And I might be wrong about that. The cancer may go too deep. I hope it doesn't. You know, I still have affinity for the place, but I certainly want it to be done correctly and equitably for everybody there.
Yeah, there are a lot of big name theaters that felt like they were the bedrock that went away, and that can be very scary. But I think that it's okay, because we need the fresh eyes. We need the new groups, and we need people to, you know, have a moment not staring into the "I could be famous someday" kind of vibe that was improv, and actually like look at improv for what it is. Right. Mm-hmm. Like they can go. I like the, we were talking about with Players Workshop, such that it's like, it's for people to really truly soak up the whole breadth of improv, and you don't have to be looking to be famous to do it. Or maybe you are, but it's an excellent like beginning to like get you started in this world. Like, I think that there's not enough respect for that, for like the idea of this like basic knowledge. Like, I was just thinking about how I was like, I need to go take somebody else's 101 class. I need that right now. That's like where I'm at. I need somebody to remind me what yes and is. You know what I mean? Because it's just been like, I got to wipe off these cobwebs, you know? And I feel like it's that way for everything, not just, not just performing, which we haven't done in a while, but, you know, what's it like to community build? What's it like to create a show? You know, what's it like to market this in this climate? You know, because there are ups and downs. I live in Austin, right? So previous to the past couple of years where South by Southwest wasn't as big a deal, it's usually like takes over the whole town. So like, for instance, when you're creating your show schedule for the year, you can just call March awash. Like, just don't plan any good shows. Don't have anything. Use that time to be focusing on other things for later, because ain't nobody coming to your theater to watch your thing when, like, U2's playing two doors down. Like, it's just not happening, right? And so when you look at what goes on in your community, your city that you live in, and like develop it from there, and be able to look at all the different things, not just the famous theaters, but all the indie theaters and how we work together. And it's like, oh, it looks like this group of indie theaters is doing a short festival at the end of February. Let's make sure that our stuff is kind of low key so we can draw some attention to them because they're doing a great thing. Like, there's a lot about community building that is outside of your own theater even. And I think that Fresh Eyes at Second City and maybe some of the larger, more clout filled theaters closing will actually be helpful because it'll allow us to see the breadth of great creativity going on.
That'd be awesome. Honestly, that would be fantastic. I actually, a friend of mine, Annie Schiffman from Downstage Media, a social media guru who helps theater companies specifically, I partnered with her and we started something called profitableimprov.com. And what it is it's basically a survey where we want improv companies, theater groups, troupes, whatever it is, to fill out this survey about how they're making money. Where they're making money, what's profitable for them, what's not. Do they pay their actors? Do they not? Do they, you know, we want to get an idea of where the state of the industry, especially now, given how many theaters are closing. And like you said, to your point, who's doing what and who's succeeding and how. Mm-hmm. And so the concept is anybody who fills it out gets all of the information, right? It's all anonymous. It's a third party Philadelphia agency that's conducting the survey. So we don't see whose information it goes in there, but we do. Everybody who participates gets 67% of the improv companies have a corporate arm. 32% make more money from t-shirt sales than they do from the beer, whatever. So, you know,
these might not be actual facts.
Yeah. These are farther away, closer in the mirror than they should. And the idea behind the whole thing is literally, let's start that conversation. What's working for people. And let's give that out to everybody because all boats rise. If we all understand what's working, and then that might shift geographically, right? If this is working in Austin, that may not work in Cleveland. But in the Midwest area, what is working, what appears to be working for a majority of theaters is if you do the extra show on Saturday, or if you do the, you know, a smaller house, whatever that math is, but you can start to have an understanding. And I don't feel like there's a lot of statistics or facts around specifically improv-based theater companies and troupes. And so, we've gotten about 36 companies to participate. We'd like to get to 100, and then, you know, really just take it from there. And the reason we call it profitable improv is because of that exact reason. Improvisers need to get paid. Companies need to make money. And are there ways that they can be doing what they're doing better in order to do that? I've made a living off of improv for the last 30 years, a good living. And it's possible. It's out there. It's totally there. It's just a matter of approaching it and figuring out how you can fit into the stream that will allow you the largest amount of revenue.
ProfitableImprov.com sounds like such a great resource. And I look forward to, you know, helping build the number of theaters that are in there, because I think the more information that we have, literally the better off we all are.
I couldn't agree more. And that's why we're giving it all back. Anybody who participates is going to get the information. I mean, hopefully down the road, the idea would be that maybe to put together a you know, symposium with people coming in saying, you know, based on this data, we, as you know, the scientists can look at it and say, based on this data, we know here's where you can make money, put your focus on this level of marketing. And, you know, this is the type of construction of space that you want to do, whatever that is. I don't know. I don't know what it is, but I don't know if anybody does. And I think the more information and data we can get around it without getting to, you know, I'm not a big data guy or computer.
But they'll have to be. You're right. That somebody has to go through that data and look for, you know, similarities, differences, what's going on, you know, and send back. It's lucky and good that you have this third party company to do that, because then, you know, you get a bunch of stuff. Maybe you get stuff like in big cities where the population is over X, this thing works. Whereas in smaller cities, this method works. I mean, it's a wild situation. That's the other thing too. Even just the idea that a person in a small town who thinks, well, we can't do this. There's only 50 people in this town. We can't do it. And then they look at it and they're like, turns out there's 200 improv theaters flourishing in small towns. This is how.
And this is what they're doing. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly it.
Why not empower people? It brings me back to what we were talking about at the very beginning, which is like, we have this skill to talk to people on stage. We have this ability to make people feel comfortable with us immediately, right? We get up on stage and it's like, what's up, best friends? And everybody responds to us with like, oh my God, you are my best friend. Like, and that is why we're the people who can be the ones who ask these tough questions, like, how much money do you make? And like, what's it from? And people will answer. And it's literally purely because you have a sweet heart, because you're like, kindness is like, all I want to do is make you better. That's all I want.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, my whole effort here, even this podcast is to make theater people better. It's for a person who lives in Idaho who's like, yeah, I've done all these monologues and I really like it. And I have this great YouTube channel, but like, what happens after that? And it's like, hey, there's 50,000 jobs you could possibly have with those skills that you have. Here are some people who you can meet, who you can emulate. You know, to that end, may I ask you, you said you've been working full time in creative stuff and doing really well. What is the form that you work in now? You're running an improv theater, clearly deeply profitable. You're running a statistics website.
No, I'm going to sound
very profitable as well.
No profit in there. No.
So how do the paychecks come in? And how can my people who are listening also make paychecks like you?
I would happily give them a roadmap. And I will tell you right now, listen, you have this spark. You have this creativity. IBM did a study in 2015 that CEOs, 60% of CEOs want creativity over integrity in their hires, because the complexity of business is going to take creative solutions. For far too long, creative people have thought that, well, this is a soft skill. What we're taught in schools is this idea that we are effectively human computers. We're there to either add things up or make things, or make sure things are correct in the metrics or in the data. Or we are the robots of, we're last year's model of robot when we assemble the door onto the car, right? Here's the thing. We all have this creative ability, and the creativity is what's going to allow us to really expand, explore, and evolve these companies. So if right now you're an improviser, you should be working for I don't want to be this strong about it, but I feel this strongly about it.
It's okay. It's your life. You can be strong about it.
Right? Because I feel like I've talked to so many people and I have worked with so many people like, good Lord, you're so incredibly talented. Why are you still doing what you're doing and making that minimum wage job? You just go apply yourself with your creativity. Go work for an agency, go work for a PR firm, go work for a marketing agency, go work for an ad agency. Start off, you know what, if you got to start off as an intern or whatever that is, start showing them your brilliance with your writing, with your performing. Make the niche for yourself. Go into that ad agency and say, hey, wouldn't it be great if you could show models of what a commercial is going to look like instead of a storyboard? Great. I've got a troupe of actors right here. We're improvisers. Give us 30 scripts. Better yet, give us one script. We'll give you 30 different takes on it and we'll shoot 10 of them. And it'll be rough and dirty and it'll be amazing. Give us $20,000 for that. Oh, yeah. Okay. Because I would have to pay my storyboard artist $20,000. So yeah, I can see the value in that. Make whatever you're doing valuable. What I've done is I started working in meetings and events. I helped build Second City Communications in that arena. We'd get hired to do after dinner shows. After a while, we started writing original scripts for the actual meetings, right? There are sales meetings and things along those lines. Then I became a creative director at Second City and I was... And every time as an actor, I looked at the director and I saw that person is making more money than I am. I want that job. I became a director. I saw that the creative director is making more money than I was. I want that job. Then I realized if I do all three jobs, I make even more money. And then after I left Second City, I was like, well, if I also produce, I make all the monies. You know, I can do the whole nine yards. And so I'm a freelance host and MC. So I still host meetings. For a great day rate every day. And honestly, this year is going to be my best year I've ever had by three times as much. So in the worst of times, by figuring out what was going to be needed, I was able to insert myself in a little niche of, hey, I'll be your Zoom host. I'll be your virtual meeting host. I'll make it fun. I'll make it interesting and engaging, just what I do on stage. But I realize that this is a broadcast that I'm in and I'm a performer. So I'm going to be your TV host. Your people are going to love it. You're going to be really happy that you don't have to do it. All of these clients were like, yeah, no brainer. Duh. I was doing one client in the morning, one client in the afternoon, and another client in the evening. I was triple booked for each day for some of these meetings. Now, it takes time to get to that level, but all of that is there. As an improv group or a troupe, go into your local convention and tourist bureau. Go in there and say, what conventions do you have coming in town? Great. Then go contact them. What associations are in town? Associations have to have meetings. So this is just one vein, right?
Ooh, side thing to what you're saying, not just the Conventions Bureau, also go to like the education, like the school district in the area and sign up to be a person who's allowed to be in schools. Then you can be like entertainment for their things, or you can come in and teach like an improv workshop to kids, but you have to like sign up to be a person who's allowed to do kid stuff. Yeah. Like, you get checked, like background checks to make sure you can like go into schools. But if you get that paperwork done, you're on a short list of people who they will call and pay money, lots of money to do these things.
And then do the stacking of it. Yeah, that's absolutely brilliant, because it's all about stacking all of these things that you offer. You want to specialize, but you want to do it for everybody. So the idea being that, hey, this mom and dad who has their kid in the school who you did this thing for, hear about your, you know, oh, what company is that? Well, we're, you know, Improv Folks. Improv Folks, they have a theater in town. You know what? Let's go see the Improv Folks show. They worked with Sally. Sally really liked it. Yeah, let's go see that improv show. Great. Now you've started building up this relationship, this brand identity that allows you to be, you know, the hometown brand. Now it's like, hey, great. Dad sees the show and he says, you know what? It'd be great. I see that you guys do corporate training. I'd love to bring your company into mine and have them do a little workshop for my people. It would be fun. And it, maybe they'd learn something. Fantastic. Now you've just, you've done this, all of this outreach that you've gotten paid for. It's the best media that you can get because it's word of mouth, and people trust word of mouth above all other kind of social media or any type of marketing or advertising. And you are building this reservoir of goodwill towards what you do creatively. And I just think you, I happen to believe that improvisers are the best. They're the best type of people because they're always super smart. They have such a high reference level. They study everything. They're curious about everything, and they want to know all of these facts and things. They figure stuff out. The improvisers are the ones that, yeah, I figured out how to build a website. It's like, you know what? Accountants aren't doing that. There's so many other, you know, areas of work that aren't going to, I'm going to go fail, but I'm going to figure this thing out. Yeah, because you have this great muscle that you've been working on that you think is only good in this one area. It's the most, the best skill that you can have. Forbes calls improv a meta skill. It's applicable everywhere, and it's absolutely the truth. And so the idea that there's not money out there to be had is complete nonsense. Everyone can be making this kind of living. Everyone can be making this kind of income. It doesn't all have to be from performing. Use that creativity, that innate creativity that you've been able to tap into. My book is called The Playmaker Mindset. And what it is it takes an average a marketing director in a company of two-way radio devices and takes them through an improv course at a place called Players Workshop. I don't know how that got in there. Anyway, it's a fictional story. But the idea is that this guy goes through this training and then shares it with his team and everything that they're able to do because of that. Is exactly what the company needs in half the time, a fraction of the time. Improvisers do that on a daily basis. You name one area that that somebody wants to get into, or they think, oh, I wish I could work in that area. I'll tell you three ways that you can be right now. But obviously, I don't feel passionate about it at all.
No, you're not at all passionate.
Yeah, there's no energy behind that at all. Mm-mm. Sorry, I'm so low energy tonight.
Oh, man. I just asked you what you had for breakfast. All you said was eggs.
I feel like I just harangued everybody, but I there's so many conversations where people aren't, they don't have the confidence that what they do, which by the way is miraculous, it's magical, has so much value. And it's that, that space, that gap between the belief of value and the ability that keeps them from making that money. And there is money to be made, honest money, good money. I mean, like support your wife and kids money, support your spouse, support your dreams, funnel that money into your theater so that it can do those shows, the experimental shows that won't make any money, but they're really cool. So yeah, it's there. It just got to go and get a little creative about it.
Mm, I like it. I like this way of looking at creativity, not just as, you know, painting and doing arts and being in theater, but also using your own innate skills in the world, trying to find ways to find the value. I like the finding the value with the other people, what they need, and then give it to them. That's really smart. I'm always thinking about that with reference to storytelling. Like I mentioned earlier, I'm like really obsessed with knowing when I see if there's a bunch of different kinds of stories that are coming out all at once, I'm like, oh, I see. Okay. So culturally we like dark heroes now. That's what's happening.
Right.
You know, and I notice those things because I am a writer. So then I'm like, oh, okay, I got to be in the mix. But I love this idea that if you just tune yourself to look for, okay, what's happening in the world right now and what do you really need? I remember at the beginning of the pandemic, I was like, if maids aren't millionaires by the end of this, I don't know what's going to happen. Like the number one thing that people need right now, cleaning, clean it up, mm-hmm. Get this clean, disinfect it, get rid of it, right? I was like, oh man, to be working at a place like that. And you know, well, you were talking about there's lots of groups that, like, you know, I thought we were going to be like, oh, we love them. They're super great. Like waiters, you know, delivery people. I thought they would be the gold standard, but I guess they're still the, you know, gum on the bottom of my shoe. I love them. I appreciate them. And I realized how much we needed them so intensely. Right. But that's the other thing, too, is this idea that, like, we as creatives can see what people really need versus what the market says that they need, right? Like, nobody was like, the market wasn't like, you know what, we need some Zoom hosts. But you were like, hey, guess what people hate doing and what I can do to take that away from you. And that was a great flip.
But here's the flip of it, because you have to sell them what they need and you have to sell them what they want, but give them what they need.
Oh.
So that's the twist. That's the little plot twist. Because they're not going to buy what they need. They don't even know what they need. They have no idea what they need. They think they do. They don't have a clue. And this is every salesperson's sort of issue, right? Is that, oh, I've got this great product. If just they would realize they need it. No, you have to go in and talk to them about what they want and talk about what outcomes they're looking for. And then let them know, yeah, I'm going to 100% going to deliver those outcomes for you. By the way, this is how I do it. And there it is. I haven't told them what they need because, frankly, they're not going to listen to me. Mm-hmm. We don't listen to our doctors. We don't listen to our mechanics. We don't listen to our politicians. We don't listen to our news. Why in the name of God are they going to listen to you about what they need for their meeting? No, not going to happen. But if I go in and say, oh, your outcome, you want engagement, you want a little bit of entertainment, you want to make sure that there's a thread through the entire meeting, and you want to make sure that somebody who kind of understands your business is able to talk about and recap what people are talking about in their presentations. Well, here's what I do. What I do is I act as a thread for your meeting so that I'm able to recap all of the presentations and talk about it knowledgeably, but with a little bit of fun, and engage your audience at the same time. Does that sound like something you need? Because you just told me that's what you wanted, you know? And so it's like, here it is. I'm going to do that exact thing for you. By the way, I'm going to do it the way that I've been doing it successfully for 30 years, and you're going to love it.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And that's the part. I think there's a huge thing. Frankly, there's part of me that wants to set up a sales class for improvisers. Improvisers are the best salespeople who hate selling. The idea of selling is the one thing that scares improvisers. Well, I don't want to come off as salesy. I don't want to do that. You don't. Don't do that. Don't be a salesy person. Listen. Use that gift from improv. Just listen to understand and then serve them. Be in service to them. Be have their backs. And I will tell you right now, 9 times out of 10, you will get that sale. You will provide that service and they will love you for having done it. I got to get off this soapbox. I'm sorry.
This is a soapbox that could be sold as a $1 million workshop. No, please. This is great advice. This is great stuff that, like, people really do need to know. I'm telling you, that's why we save it for the end. These are the diehard. Thank you. If you're listening, you know you're a diehard. You're in it. And I appreciate that. Yeah. Like, but this is good stuff. And this is, like, great ways of using improv to pivot in the world that we live in right now. Right.
Right.
There are jobs that we've never heard of happening right now. And there are a lot of jobs that nobody wants that you don't have to have because you have other skills. Like
really valuable skills.
Yeah, absolutely. You do not need to be doing some of these random, ridiculous jobs that they're talking about because you know how to do other stuff.
Yeah.
It's really just a matter of figuring out how to make your resume look cool, but that's easy enough. I'm sure there's a few YouTube videos on that. And just figuring out your version of the pivot. Right? What do you bring to the table? That's the other thing. And I appreciate talking to you even just, like, up top about this idea of, like, being comfortable in front of people and, like, being able to talk to them. I consider that my superpower, right?
Right.
People always think they know me when they meet me. They think I'm someone they know.
Right.
And I love that. I love that because it makes them talk to me. And then they, you are not Lorraine, are you? I'm not Lorraine. I'm not I'm Amy. Hi. You know, but it's okay. It's all right. I'm into it and I'll like play along. I'll be like, I heard the Church Bazaar was good. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I cannot believe what Who doesn't love cookies? Up to.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, she made those cookies early in the morning, you know, that's what happens. That's or whatever. What like,
yeah, right.
And then, but you know, it's a lovely thing. And now I'm always like, oh yeah, it's fine. Yeah, I love it. Let's chat about whatever. Yeah. Like, and I'll talk to anyone, especially these days. Today, I had way too long a conversation with a person at a drive-thru window because I was just like so starved for social activity. Right. I hadn't talked to you yet. Now I've had this like nice like a couple hour long conversation with somebody. I'm all like, oh man, I'm so socialized. But like earlier in the day, I was all like, hey, what's going on? Is that a thank you for the coffee? Yeah, your mask is nice.
It's nice to hear this because my wife is like, whenever we go out, it's always, you know, I'll strike up a conversation. I'm not an extrovert. I'm absolutely one of those introverted extroverts, right? Or extrovert, introvert, whatever that is, who just, when I have enough of people, I have to go be alone and like let all of it out. But I absolutely love talking to people who, you know, it's like in the cab when we were in Ireland. We'd get into these cabs and I'd start talking to the guy about, hey, so what about this? And all of a sudden we find out, you know, his cousin went up to Northern Ireland to buy a car and, you know, they were very scared about it. So he called his other cousin and the three of them went up because you don't go up to Northern Ireland alone, not if you're from Dublin. And I'll tell you something. And so we get into it and she just shakes her head like, why can't we just go to the, we were going to go to the restaurant. Why can't we just go to the And it's because those stories are amazing and people want to communicate. They want to talk.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely fascinating a lot of the time. And when it's not, it's actually a great character study, you know? So it always has that value. And I think a lot of improvisers can do that. And it's an invaluable resource that again, can just make you a lot of money.
Oh man, listen, Jeff, thank you so much for being on the podcast. This has been a great conversation, just like full of like super good ideas on like how to make money with improv and how to like use your creativity for what it's worth, not just languish in like, oh, this is a cool idea or like an idea notebook that I'm just feeling no one will read. You could make money with this. And in the world where everything's a pivot, these are your skills, guys. Like, use it. So thank you so much for sharing all of this stuff.
Oh, it's been my absolute pleasure. I absolutely, as you can tell, I get super passionate about it. So this has been, I love talking about it. So thanks for letting me ramble on and thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. Yay.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.